2 weeks ago, I spoke to Tom Doherty, as I said. My guest tonight has a completely different view of what went on. And his name is Ben Irwind. Some people got so angry about Ben's book that they demanded Harvard University Press withdraw the book because of alleged historical inaccuracies. His is called The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler. Born in Sydney, son of Jewish immigrants, after attending Sydney Uni, he headed off to the US to work in the film industry. And he ended up, well, for the time being, at the University of California in Berkeley, where he wrote his PhD dissertation on Hollywood's dealings with the Nazis, and he's now based at Harvard University. Ben, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Ben, there used to be a popular perception that Hollywood in the 30s was just full of lefties pushing communist propaganda onto the screens. What got you interested in digging around about the Nazi connection?
I actually started out looking for something completely different. I was at the German State Archive in Berlin, and I discovered Hitler's opinions of movies, and especially American movies. I found that he watched movies every night, and his opinions were noted down faithfully by his secretaries. And I was going through these opinions, and I found them fascinating. For example, he loved Laurel and Hardy. He giggled through Laurel and Hardy movies, and he cried during Greta Garbo movies, and he liked King Kong, but he disliked Tarzan. And I was finding these interesting, sometimes disturbing, sometimes completely normal opinions. But then in the very same collection, in Hitler's own personal collection, I found a letter from the German branch of 20th Century Fox to Hitler. And it was a letter dated January 1938. And the letter essentially asked if Hitler would give his opinion of the value of American movies in Germany, and ended, "We would be honored if Hitler would send just a brief note to explain what he thinks about American movies." And the letter was signed Heil Hitler. Now, this was on 20th Century Fox letterhead, and at the bottom of the page were the words Heil Hitler. And that was what really got me started and led to 9 years of research.
Thanks for that, Ben. You establish Hitler's obsession with films, and you find a document dated embarrassingly late in the piece. But yeah, it's fair to say that Hitler's intentions for the Jews, short of the final solution, was well and truly established in the early 30s.
That's true. There's a myth that people in the United States did not know what was going on in Germany. And it's completely untrue. And historians have already shown this. This is nothing new. In, for example, February and March of 1933, if you just look through the New York Times or the Washington Post or the Los Angeles Times, you'll see that there are about 20 articles on the subject of the persecution of Jews in Germany. Now, these should have been on the front pages of these newspapers. They weren't on the front pages, but they were reported. People knew what was going on, and the studio heads were especially aware of what was going on. I found one letter from the head of Universal Pictures, Carl Laemmle, to William Randolph Hearst, the media magnate, basically saying that, and this was in 1932, a full year before Hitler came to power, saying that he was worried that if Hitler came to power, this would lead to the deaths of many thousands of Jews, not just in Germany, but in Central Europe as well.
And by then, Victor Galanz, I think, has written The Extermination of the Jews, the famous left-wing British publisher.
I mean, it was widely known. The persecution was reported as it was happening, and I found evidence that the studios were still making concessions to the Germans, even after Kristallnacht in November 1938, and even after the Second World War broke out. For a full year, Hollywood movies were still playing in Nazi Germany.
Now, we discussed in our last episode on Hitler and Hollywood the response to Universal's All's Quiet on the Western Front. The Nazis hated it. They organised demos against it before they came to power. And when they got into government, you say they used the film as a reason to set up a very important regulation, Article 15.
Right. So Hollywood had always been sensitive to the demands of foreign nations. Hollywood had regularly changed movies for foreign markets. So, for example, Japan in the 1930s prohibited kissing scenes. Mexico and England prohibited religious scenes. These scenes were simply cut from those versions of the film. But what happened after All Quiet on the Western Front was completely different. Carl Laemmle essentially went to the German Foreign Office, and this was just before Hitler came to power, and he said, if I make certain cuts to the film, will you permit it in Germany? And they came back to him and said, yes, we will permit it if you make those cuts, but here is where everything changed. They then said to him, you also have to make those cuts all around the world. And the German Foreign Office, with its network of consulates and embassies, spied on Universal Pictures. All of the German diplomats around the world went out and checked that the cuts had been made. And they had been made, and so this was the first example of a Hollywood studio that was changing a movie, not just for one particular market, but all around the world, including in the United States. And that set the basis for the agreement, which lasted all through the 1930s.
We're talking at a time, Ben, when there's a bit of nip and tucking on American films for China.
Right, and this is interesting because as I was finishing my book in the final year, these reports started surfacing about how Hollywood was changing movies for China. But there is an important difference. China is censoring a whole variety of Hollywood movies, Kung Fu
Ben, can
Panda
you back
3.
off the mic just a little because you're
Sure.
popping?
So China censors many, many different kinds of American movies, Kung Fu Panda 3, Django Unchained, and has all sorts of different requirements. But what happened in the 1930s was that the Nazis systematically tried to remove two very specific things from Hollywood movies. That was anything to do with German defeat during the First World War and anything about Hitler's persecution of Jews in Germany. And those two things were systematically eliminated as a result of active cooperation between studio heads and Nazi authorities all through the 1930s. And that's a much longer lasting agreement and a much more active agreement than anything that's going on with China today.
So there was much more than simple, the three wise monkeys here. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. There's active participation with the Nazis.
That's right. The myth up to now has always been that Hollywood was simply indifferent in the 1930s and slowly but surely attacked the Nazis. But I spent 9 years in archives in around 10 US and German cities. I went through dozens of collections and I found evidence that unquestionable evidence that the studios were actively working with Nazi authorities all through the 1930s, and that explains why Hollywood didn't attack the Nazis in the 1930s. They were actively collaborating. It was not passive indifference.
What's your view of Joseph Breen at the Hays office? Your predecessor on the program said yes, he warned the studios about Nazi attitudes to Jewish films or films that the Germans would see as polluted or corrupted by Germans, but he didn't regard him as an anti-Semite. What do you think about Breen?
I went through all of the various correspondence that Breen sent. I didn't find, I found only one problematic sentence in one of his letters that led me to believe that he could be anti-Semitic. But there's also another quote that historians have circulated over the years, something he said in the late 1920s that certainly seems anti-Semitic. But the problem with what people argue about the Hays Office up to this point is that they act as if the Hays Office could tell the Hollywood studios what to do, as if the Hays Office were a group of government censors who determined what could and could not appear on the screen. That's a misrepresentation of what the Hays Office did in this period. The Hays Office were the paid representatives of the Hollywood studios, and they advised the studios on what kinds of things they should do in their movies, what kinds of changes they should make. But they were the representatives of the studios, and the studios could ultimately and frequently overrule the Hays Office. And so the myth that the studios didn't make anti-Nazi movies in the 30s because the Hays Office wouldn't let them is completely untrue. If it was the studios who told the Hays Office what to do.
One of the other main characters I didn't have time to cover in our previous program, and that's the German diplomat George Giesling, the German consul in L.A., and according to you, someone who built up the most extraordinary power base in the Dream Factory. How did he do it?
That's right. I discovered these documents in Germany. No one had looked at any of the German documents before. No film historians had ever looked at German documents. There are vague references to Giesling in Hollywood files that don't really explain what he was doing, but I uncovered his notes detailing his meetings with various studio executives. And essentially, he would be invited to individual Hollywood studios like Fox, for example, and he would go there, he would be screened a movie that he had said he objected to, he would watch the movie, and he would dictate cuts, and he would say, these cuts need to be made to this particular film, otherwise your studio will be banned from the German market. And so, in, for example, 20th Century Fox would then make the cuts, and Giesling would write back to Germany and say that 20th Century Fox has agreed to do these cuts and therefore they can continue doing business in Germany. This lasted all through the 1930s, and sometimes entire films were cancelled as a result of the Nazi German consul in Los Angeles's interventions.
You and I both find it extraordinary that an industry created by Jewish refugees from Europe should be so compliant. Was it... It has to simply be the money, doesn't it?
So my book is about individuals and individual decisions. Six or seven executives controlled the Hollywood studios in the 1930s. And of those executives, only one was not Jewish. And the way things worked in Hollywood in the 1930s was that screenwriters would propose ideas for productions. But ultimately, these six or seven men had the final say on what would appear in Hollywood movies. And so in my book, I show how various Jewish screenwriters, especially Herman Mankiewicz, who later wrote Citizen Kane, and Ben Heck, the most prolific screenwriter in Hollywood, they both tried to get these executives to make pictures showing what Hitler was doing to Jews in Europe. And they went to great lengths to do this, and many other Jewish groups in Hollywood also wanted this to happen. But the problem was these six or seven executives had the final say in what could appear in the screen. And Louis B. Mayer, upon examining the first ever proposal of a film about Hitler's persecution of Jews in Germany, said, "We have tremendous profits in Germany, and as far as I am concerned, this picture will never be made."
And tell us about Giesling and Warner Brothers and the Dreyfus film.
So in 1933, Giesling expelled Warner Brothers from the German market. People have said for decades that Warner Brothers left Germany because they were courageous and valiant and wanted to stand up to the Germans. I found evidence in Germany that this is absolutely untrue. Warner Brothers wanted to keep doing business in Germany, but the studio was eventually kicked out. And Warner Brothers was the first studio to invite Giesling to their studio lot, but he in the end kicked them out of Germany. And in 1937, Warner Brothers made a picture called The Life of Emile Zola, which had scenes about the Dreyfus scandal. And one day, George Giesling called up Warner Brothers and said he was very concerned about this picture. Now, Warner Brothers had absolutely no reason to even talk to Giesling because he had kicked them out of Germany. But 2 days later, Jack Warner dictated a series of cuts to this picture, and he removed the word Jew. It was never spoken in the picture, and instead of using the word Jew, which would have drawn attention to the persecution in this extremely important historical episode, he just used Dreyfus's name. And so he eliminated that word, and he did this even though he had no business in Germany anymore, even though Giesling had kicked him out of Germany.
Tell us why the Nazis banned Tarzan, the Ape Man, and Scarface from distribution in Germany.
Scarface was one of many gangster pictures that the Nazis objected to simply because they thought that this would lead to more crime in Germany. And at a censorship meeting on that film, the film company made the argument, well, Hitler has eliminated crime in Germany, so it will never come back, so this film is not dangerous. But the Nazis disagreed and banned Scarface. Tarzan was a much stranger case. At that meeting, a Nazi official, a member of the propaganda ministry, said that it was offensive that a civilized woman, that is Jane in the picture, would court, protect, and love a jungle man rather than a civilized man, that she would pick this savage jungle man over a more civilized man. And they said that this contradicts National Socialist principles, and that we have been working tirelessly to prevent the superficial distortion of the past epoch, which was completely based on sexuality, and to restore marriage and the honor of marriage in Germany. So they banned Tarzan for that reason. And, you know, these censorship decisions are very strange, and the reasons are sometimes darkly funny. But that was their reason for banning Tarzan.
On Hitler's list of filmmakers he enjoyed, there was, at least for a time, Charles Chaplin, wasn't there?
Well, actually, the Nazis objected to Chaplin. They said that he was Jewish, which he was not. And they constantly attacked Chaplin as a Jew. And Chaplin, to his credit, never publicly denied, never said that he was not a Jew. He just remained silent on the issue. But of course, he was one of the first people to stand up to Hitler in 1940 and to make The Great Dictator, in which...
Yes, it's hard to see Hitler enjoying that.
Yeah, you know, there is one file that I uncovered in Germany which proved that the propaganda ministry had a copy of The Great Dictator in their collections. Whether Hitler saw that is something that we can only speculate on. I did not find any record that he ever watched it.
Ben, let's backtrack to Giesling and Joseph Breen.
Sure.
One of the most significant and some say controversial chapters in your book is about a film project for a Sinclair Lewis novel called It Can't Happen Here. Tell us that story.
Sure. In 1935, Sinclair Lewis, the best-selling Nobel Prize-winning novelist, wrote a novel on fascism coming to America, and he called it Can't Happen Here, and it was wildly successful. And MGM purchased the screen rights to this picture even before the book had been published. They wanted to turn it into a massive production showing fascism coming to America and the superiority of liberal democracy. And MGM cast some of the biggest names, Lionel Barrymore, Wallace Beery, Jimmy Stewart, in this film, and was going to make a great production. And at the last minute, it was cancelled in 1936 by Louis B. Mayer for the once, and then cancelled again in 1939 after George Giesling called up the studio and complained about the picture. And Sinclair Lewis issued a remarkable statement to the American press at the time. He said that democracy is surely on the defensive when two European dictators can have a film cancelled, causing a loss of hundreds of thousand dollars to a producer. And he said, I wrote It Can't Happen Here, but I begin to think it can. And I think what Sinclair Lewis was saying, and what really is important here in my book, is that the Nazis not only prevented Hollywood studios from making pictures about Nazism and about the persecution of Jews, but in this period, Hollywood was not even able to make a picture about the superiority of democracy over fascism. And that was the darkest moment, I think, that the studios got to in the entire decade.
There was, of course, some very energetic activity by Hollywood writers, directors, who were bitterly unhappy about what was going on. But they never got much traction.
That's right. Only on one occasion, and in fact, it was when this film, It Can't Happen Here, was cancelled for a second time, did the Hollywood screenwriters in a group that they'd created called the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League say anything about what the studios were doing. This group, the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, would speak out against Hitler in their newsletters, but they never spoke out against the studio executives who were doing business with Hitler until one moment in the middle of 1939, when Louis B. Mayer first cancelled It Can't Happen Here because the Nazi German consul objected to it, and then a week later invited the editors of 10 of the most prominent Nazi newspapers to his studio. And now this included the editor of Focusche Beobachter, Hitler's personal newspaper. And they were treated to a goodwill tour of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
I'm sorry, what year is this?
1939. they were invited, these editors, these Nazi editors were invited to the MGM studio lot, and the Hollywood Anti-Nazi League, this group of Hollywood screenwriters, finally spoke out and said, we cannot understand how you could have cancelled It Can't Happen Here and how you could welcome these Nazis to your studio. And so that was the only moment that I found that they spoke out against the studio's business dealings with the Nazis.
We're discussing the book, The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler, with its author Ben Erwin, who's a junior fellow at the Society of Fellows at Harvard University, apparently a pretty worthy collective. This is the second part in our series on Hollywood and Hitler. Let's look at the extraordinary attacks upon you and the book that are percolating. One argues that there is that you don't have the documentary evidence connecting Warner, for example, caving into Giesling.
I actually haven't seen that, and it's fascinating because in all of the attacks on me, no one has identified a single factual error. No one has asked me to produce any of my documents to show that I found these things. If anyone did ask me, I would be able to produce anything because I was very careful. I thought that people might call me out on quotations and might say, this couldn't have happened, show us evidence. No one asked me for any evidence. Instead, what people seem to be focusing on is this word collaboration. And they just say that this word does not describe what happened, even though it was the word that was used by all of the parties involved. It was the word used by Nazis to describe their relationship with the studio executives, and it was the word that the studio executives used to describe their relationship with the Nazis. But no one has called me out on a single factual error. And
I thought David Denby, who seems to be leading the campaign against you, of course, the very famous film critic for the New Yorker, is citing chapter and verse of your scholarly shortcomings.
If you read his article carefully, you'll see he doesn't actually draw attention to any factual inaccuracies. He focuses on sort of tangential matters in the book, but he couldn't possibly identify a factual error unless he went to the archives. Now, the fact is that no one else has seen the materials that I've seen. No one has gone to Germany and gone through all of these materials. It's very easy to say, oh, this couldn't be true. But unless you go and check my findings against the citations, you can't prove that it isn't true. And he hasn't disputed any quotations. He hasn't disputed that I found what I found in the archives. He's really engaging in a polemic that isn't based on any materials at all.
Some basic facts in your thesis look absolutely incontrovertible, and the studio bosses could have stood up to the likes of Breen and Giesling, but they didn't. Were any of the studio heads, was there one shining light of someone who said, this is just not good enough?
Not the studio heads, unfortunately. And what's especially unfortunate about that is, as I said, the studio heads had the power to make motion pictures. Other people didn't. And not one studio head went against the grain in the 1930s. But there were screenwriters who begged the studio heads to make anti-Nazi pictures, to show the world what Hitler was doing to Jews and to mobilize public opinion against the Nazis. Herman Mankiewicz wrote the first screenplay on this subject in June 1933, very, very early, and I uncovered the only remaining copy of that script. And he essentially predicted that Hitler would soon start killing Jews. And he tried, but he was unsuccessful. And Ben Hecht, more than any other individual in the United States, tried to draw attention to the genocide when the first news leaked in late 1942. And he too pleaded with studio heads to draw attention to the German crime against the Jewish people. And again, they did not follow his advice.
A couple of years ago, I wrote a column on the backstory of Casablanca. And it's, as you know, it's a remarkable film in that a great number of the cast members are absolutely distinguished A-list German Jewish actors who'd fled the industry, knowing damn well what was ahead of them. I just find this idea that you can avert your eyes, your block your ears, and be willfully ignorant, extraordinary. Let's go back to Mayer, because he was really the king of Hollywood. I understand he was the only American who could actually travel around the world without a passport.
Well, it's certainly true that Louis B. Mayer was the most powerful man in Hollywood in the 1930s. And he is a central character in my story. But he really was only significant because he was such a powerful executive. Essentially, what he was doing was following the same policy that all of the studio heads were doing. Jack Warner of Warner Brothers, Harry Cohn of Columbia, Carl Laemmle of Universal Pictures. He was essentially doing the same thing, only his studio was more powerful than the other studios, and so he played a slightly bigger part in creating the industry policy, as it was known at the time. And industry policy was that the studios would not attack the Nazis in this period in order to preserve their German business.
Meanwhile, back in Germany, you've got Hitler, the great film fan, and Goebbels, his propaganda minister, recognising the vast power of this medium to win friends and influence people, which
That's right.
takes us to, you know, Leni Riefenstahl and her propaganda films for him. I found it interesting that, you know, decades after the war, Riefenstahl was still getting away with it.
Yeah, and you know, one of the things that I discovered that was especially fascinating to me was that with the Germans' great massive propaganda ministry, and with all of their efforts to make films that indoctrinated audiences in Germany about the value as they saw it in National Socialism, Joseph Goebbels, the head of the propaganda ministry, was deeply jealous of the Hollywood studios, and he felt that the Hollywood studios produced much better propaganda than he ever could. And it's true that there are some pictures that Hollywood made in the 1930s that show a kind of sympathy with authoritarianism, and with fascism. And these pictures were marketed in Germany by the studios as fascist propaganda. And the Nazis loved this. And Joseph Goebbels awarded prizes to a whole series of American movies. And he said, we cannot do what the Americans can do. We lack their light comedy touch. And he was jealous that the Americans could make movies that occasionally showed that authoritarianism could be a good thing. There are examples of this. Gabriel of the White House, film from 1933, showed an American president becoming a dictator and solving the world's problems. And Goebbels thought that this picture was better than anything that the Germans could produce because it was funnier and it was more effective. And these films were screened to the Hitler Youth for educational purposes. They were awarded national prizes. And that's an especially interesting chapter of the story I tell, I think, in the book.
There's an opportunity for you to do a sequel or for some other bright scholar to tackle it, and that, of course, would be Hollywood and Stalin. It'd be fascinating to know what was going on between the studios and the Soviet in this period. I know that the Soviet wasn't all that welcoming to American movies.
No, that's true. Not like Germany. Germany was a major market. And, you know, for me to write, I had to learn German in order to write this book. And I did it in the middle of my PhD program, and it took a couple of years, but I had to do it to look at the documents. And I suspect it would be a lot harder to learn Russian and to write that book. But I think it'd be a fascinating book because dictators were obsessed with movies, and Stalin, just like Hitler, was obsessed with movies.
I, in the last program we did on this, I told stories of my role dealing with the Hollywood industry. I was a sort of a government spokesman in negotiations with Jack Valenti, which went on for years and got very, very ugly. Mm-hmm. And I pointed out to the Australian listener how much hardball Hollywood played then and plays now. We were told at one stage that if an idea I'd suggested to the federal government here to have a buying agent by Hollywood films in the US rather than paying the highest per capita price on earth for them. Valenti flies to Honolulu Airport, intercepts the Prime Minister Whitlam and says that he will put a total ban on any American film or movies or television programs being seen in Australia. And that panicked the government, and so they gave up. Later, face-to-face with me, he made it quite clear that Hollywood would, that he, through his immense political influence in Washington, could organise effectively a trade embargo on Australia, that we'd suddenly find we weren't selling this or that category of produce. They really are tough cookies.
Well, Hollywood is definitely a complicated place. I would just say that this chapter that I tell in my book is really much darker than anything else. Hollywood is a business like other businesses, and there are horrible things that happen in Hollywood. There are also great things. I believe that I actually...
Well, the industry has never been more vibrant creatively than it is right now.
I mean, especially television these days is incredible. I would say that Hollywood is responsible for many good things, many bad things, but I am not out there to engage in a polemic against Hollywood. I am writing a very specific story about a dark period in Hollywood history. In fact, I believe the darkest, in which the Hollywood studio executives actively collaborated with the Nazi regime. Now, this isn't representative of Hollywood. This doesn't mean that Hollywood does this all of the time. This is an exceptional case. And in the book, I'm very careful only to make claims about what Hollywood did. But I think certainly that this is the darkest moment in the history of the movie capital.
Yeah, I mislaid a note telling people where they can actually have direct contact with you. Tell me about that.
Well, I actually just agreed to launch the book at the Sydney Jewish Museum on December 18 at 7 p.m. I'll be giving a talk there. I am lucky enough to be coming back for a couple of weeks of summer in Australia, and it just so happens that they had a date that worked. So I'll be there on December 18, the Sydney Jewish Museum, on December 18 at 7 p.m. to show really a series of film clips and to show some of the documents I found and to explain not so much my arguments and not to give a specific reading, but really to explain how I discovered what I discovered and how I was led to certain inescapable conclusions.
One hopes that you get a phone call from a bright, talented young documentary filmmaker who wants to do a film version of the book because, of course, an appropriate montage of clips backing up your researchers would be a very compelling way to win the argument.
Yeah, I mean, I've noticed I've been giving talks about my book for the past few weeks, and despite the controversy, audiences have been fascinated, and it's hard to make claims, for example, that collaboration isn't the correct term when you see the word collaboration in document after document that I put in front of audiences.
Well, thank you for your collaboration with me today, Ben, and I've enjoyed it. Ben Irwin, The Collaboration, Hollywood's Pact with Hitler, published by the Harvard University Press. And now we're going to look at things called clusters. I think you might be intrigued.